This is a Defocus Media production. What's up, everyone? It's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Daryl Glover.
And I'm Dr. Jennifer Lyerly, resident optometry nerd.
And welcome to Defocus Media, optometry's number one podcast, where we discuss the hottest topics, latest technology, eyewear, practice management, and more. So sit back, relax, and defocus.
Welcome to a new Defocus Media podcast video cast. I'm Jennifer Lyerly, and I'm here with Daryl Glover. And we've got a guest that is a dear friend of the Defocus podcast, and we're always so excited to get a chance to check in with them, Dr. Howard Purcell. And he's dealing with a lot right now, just like all of us are in this time of COVID-19, and getting his perspective on a lot of things going on, both around the virus and what's going on in the greater community of optometry, is going to be an excellent thing this evening. So excited to get this chance to talk to you, Dr. Purcell.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Looking forward to talking about a lot of important things we have going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just get caught up with your life. What's happening right now in your world as president of NICO?
Wow. Where to begin? Well, let me start off by saying I'm a year and a half, almost a year and three quarters into the job, and I cannot wait to get to work every day. I love being in academia. It has been such an inspiration for me, being around students who are so excited about optometry. I mean, to be truthful, when you're in the industry side, and I loved my time in industry, 25 years there, you do hear a little bit of moaning and groaning here and there. And when you hang around students all day, it's all about the greatest profession ever. They're all going to be the best optometrist they could ever be, and they're so excited. It's their dream come true. It's what they've always wanted. It's incredibly inspiring. So I am really enjoying every minute of it, obviously, with the issues at hand. It has created some significant complexities, but you know what? People step up. It's really interesting, and I'm sure you guys have seen that this in your world too. You really get to know people in times of difficulty, and I could not be any prouder of our faculty, our administration, our students, and the way they've managed through this, and I'm happy to talk through more of the details, but you know, I love it. I'm enjoying it. If we just set aside for a moment, if we possibly can, COVID-19, and we just talk about optometric education, I mean, we have challenges in optometric education, there's no doubt, but the reality is it's an amazing profession that enables us to do and practice in so many different ways. And, you know, I recognize that it's hard to see the end of the tunnel right now, but I know we're going to come out the other side. We're going to be as strong as ever, and we're going to continue to move this profession forward in the way we always have. So I'm loving it. It's very different for me. I mean, I'm not the traditional optometry school president, you know, 25 years in industry, 10 years in private practice. And in there, I had 5 years at Nova Southeastern. So I hope that my background is bringing the right kind of perspective at the right time. But I've surrounded myself with a great team of people. And that's what it's all about. Just like this amazing team at Defocus Media, right?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for the kind words there. But, you know, tell me just a little bit more about that transition, because industry, you know, academia, I mean, it's just like two different worlds completely. I mean, you know, I had the honor of hanging out with you not too long ago down at SECO, and I know you were talking about, you know, when you're in industry and you're in academia, when you need certain things, you find out who your true friends are at the end of the day when it comes to that. But let's just talk about that transition, because I know that was one hell of a transition to go from industry.
Yeah, but before I get to that, I have to comment on what you said, because I did joke at the meeting. And by the way, I really appreciated you guys being there. But I did joke about the fact that when you don't have that credit card anymore, you do tend to find out who your friends are. Everybody wanted to party with me before. Everybody wanted to hang out with me at the bar. And now I'm kind of down to my inner circle, you know. But you know, all kidding aside, it has been a significant transition. But, you know, I've learned a lot. And you, I think you heard me say this, Daryl, but I'll say it here. And that is that, you know, I had responsibility for 25 years to engage with the schools and colleges, and my teams were always responsible for that relationship. And I visited all the schools, and I really felt like I had a really good handle on, you know, what was going on in optometric education. Then I made the transition over, and what I realized really quickly was how little I actually knew. And in fact, perhaps more importantly, had I known more about what the real issues were, both the strengths and the opportunities in optometric education, I think I could have been a much better partner. And that was the emphasis behind this meeting that you attended. And as I said, I really appreciated you guys being there, where we tried to bring together the media, the employers, and the industry. And I'll talk about that if you'd like me to. But one of the interesting components of that was employers. If you think about this for a minute, the schools and colleges, and perhaps rightly so, and you can make an argument for it, although I'm not in that camp, have really held the employers at arm's length. You know, we're not going to let you in our doors. You know, if you want to do something with our students, you have to do it off campus. And when I first came and looking at that, it was odd to me. Think about this. You know, tell me any other program that is developing a product. Our product happens to be a student. And we keep our employers, the people who are ready to hire them, as far away as we possibly can. I mean, really, intuitively, it makes no sense. But look, I get the politics of it, but it really makes no sense. We believe that we should expose our students to all the opportunities out there. We want to expose our students to the disruptive things that are going on out there. I think we do an injustice to our students if we don't expose them to that while they're in school. I mean, you let them out after 4 years, and that's the first time they're going to engage with things like, as an example, telehealth. Who would have ever imagined that everybody would want in the game of telehealth? You know, it took, unfortunately, this incredible pandemic, which is horrific and has impacted so many of us in such a horrific way, to have everybody now saying, well, let me learn more about this telehealth thing. This sounds really interesting. We've been able to maintain our clinical activities, and I'm so proud of our team for what they've done. In emergency situations, we can see patients. We can use our telehealth systems. We can take people from going to emergency rooms, because we all know the situation with emergency rooms, no matter where you are in the country. I mean, New York, Washington, a couple areas that are a little worse than others. But the reality is, we all know the situations in emergency rooms right now. If we can minimize that, and telehealth has been a great vehicle. At the very least, it helps us to triage. So the transition has been actually a lot of fun. I learn every single day because I get to work with some people who've dedicated their careers to academia and are so focused on. And that's another thing, Daryl, that I think when you're not in academia, it's easy to throw stones, right? Oh, come on. These guys are producing people. They have no clue about business. They're really not, you know, what we would expect them to be. But think about this for a minute. You know, my dad went to NECO in 1954. He graduated. It was a 4-year program. Fast forward to 2020, we still have a 4-year program, yet the pressures on our faculty, and I'm not making excuses for them, I'm just sharing the reality of what I've learned. What they have to teach today in the same window of time, it's wonderful because our profession has progressed and the scope of practice has expanded. That is a wonderful thing, don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to point out the pressures it puts on our faculty to prepare these students for the future. We talk a lot at our institution, and then I'll stop, about preparing today's optometrist for tomorrow's optometry. That's what we're about. That's what we focus on every single day. And the pandemic, yes, it's an obstacle to our progress, but we're not going to let that slow us down, and we haven't let that slow us down.
I think this is a great time to talk about some of the unique things that you're doing for the students of New England College of Optometry because of the diverse background you're bringing into your position as president. So what's some of the things that stands out about what you've been able to do with the school?
Well, I'll give an example, and it's probably going to be a little controversial, but I think it gives you some perspective of what we're trying to do. So an old friend of mine, Neil Blumenthal, you might know the name. I knew Neil before he started Warby Parker. Neil and I worked together at a philanthropic group called Vision Spring that a good friend and alumni of NECO, Jordan Casolo, started. A wonderful group that goes to different parts of the world and makes sure people are cared for, with more of a hub and spoke type of concept. And I've known Neil for a long time. He was coming to Boston to speak at Harvard about his company, and he approached me and said, would you like me to come to NECO and talk to your students about the story of Warby Parker? And I thought it was a fantastic idea. Why not? But I did what I've learned to do now. By the way, one thing you learn in academia is shared governance, which is something in industry you don't know too much about. So I had to learn, and we can come back to that one. But in any case, I went to student council and I said, look, we have this opportunity to bring the founder of Warby Parker in. What do you guys think? They thought it was a fantastic idea. They were all about it. So we made this announcement. We're bringing him in. I'll fast forward and just say the room was packed, not a seat in the room, people sitting in the stairwells, etc. I mean, people really wanted to hear what he had to say. But I got a lot of very nasty comments about how dare we allow someone like that to enter into our building. And let me be clear, because, you know, the end was a good story. Neil got up there and told a story, and it's a wonderful story. And what was very clear was three things. Number one, he's an incredible entrepreneur, and most optometrists are not necessarily wired up that way. And it was so interesting to hear how he did this and what thought processes went into it and what he thinks about every day. Number two, it was clear he's incredibly philanthropic. Warby Parker gave away their 5 millionth pair of glasses several months ago, so they probably have far surpassed that now. But the third thing, and I think equally as important, was how little he knew about optometry. Mm-hmm. And he was very quick to admit that. And I thought it really led to some great conversations, which whether we like it or not, whether you think this is a good news scenario or bad, if you now walk into Warby Parker's, you're going to see full exam lanes with comprehensive eye exams going on there. And I am not taking any credit for that at all. I'm just suggesting by having the dialogue and engaging, and our students asked great questions, and he listened, and I think the end result of this was a reinforcement at the very least of, yeah, you know, I like the idea. He still likes this idea of manipulating around in some of these more virtual means, but he understood the value of a comprehensive eye exam. Now, you may not love that Warby Parker's doing comprehensive eye exams in their facilities, but the reality is I personally think it's better than trying to push some online refraction that we all know we worry about the health of our patients' eyes. So just one example, and I think it gives you an overarching example of the things that we're trying to do to expose our students. Students are so smart. You know, at our meeting, we did this industry collaborative that I think Daryl had alluded to earlier. We had a panel of students, and we basically asked them all to tell a bit about themselves, and then we opened it up for questions. We had set aside about an hour for that panel, and literally we could have gone on for 3 hours. And I was so impressed with how our students handled it. They, when they didn't know something, they didn't answer it. They showed their passion. I'm not sure what our audience expected, but they were absolutely blown away by the caliber of the optometry student today. And I will tell you, go to any optometry school in the country, and you will see an incredibly committed, smart, well-educated, and focused on helping people and making a difference in the world. It's incredibly inspiring. So, you know, bottom line was, you know, being able to see the students, engage with them, help them understand it, and having those students be in a room with all these leaders in the industry, that's the kind of thing we need to do. We can't hide things from students and hope that at some point maybe they'll see it, but not under our watch. I think quite the opposite. So that's kind of the mode we've been in, is exposing them to things. And they ask incredible questions. They have no preconceived notions about anything. And so their questions are so good and so unfiltered that I think everyone really enjoyed it. By the way, we also had a panel of faculty, and that was equally as I think productive in terms of exchanging, and really the essence of it was, so you know, and I think this helps answer your question of where we're going, is let's lift up the hood and say, we're willing to show you the good and the bad, because I believe that if we do that, we can create better partnerships with the industry in a way that can be very productive. And I want to add the caveat, because I do take this critique every once in a while. I'm not suggesting industry and employers and the media should dictate our curriculum and the way we operate from that standpoint. But what I am saying is, without them, I don't think we can be as successful as we can with them. So let's find a happy medium. It doesn't have to be you can't get in our door, or you're going to dictate everything we do and we're going to change the name of our college. But, you know, for you, no, but there's a happy median somewhere that says, let's work together. And I will tell you, they all left their competitive spirits at the door. That included the media and everybody, and they were willing to work together. And that's what resulted in the meeting in Atlanta, which turned out to be one of our last get-togethers as an organization, to say, let's sign a proclamation. I wanted people to just put their money, not their money, but put their name where their mouth is, to say, we're willing to work on these 10 outcomes. So we had 10, essentially 10 outcomes that came from that meeting of the key elements we believe we need to work on as a profession to continue to see the growth and success our profession has experienced. So I hope that gives you some perspective of the things we're trying to do. I'm really proud of the team for their creativity, and I really have loved how students have reacted to it.
Yeah, I had the opportunity of hanging out with you at CECO and being a part of this meeting. And Jen, just sitting in that room with, you know, all the industry giants, just your key opinion leaders, just the energy, the attention that was just, you know, focusing on the topic at hand. It was just one of those things that it was like, you're only going to experience that once in your life. I mean, it was so vibrant in that room.
Thank you for saying that, Daryl. If I may just interrupt you, I appreciate you saying that. And by the way, this may have happened behind your back a little bit, but you and Jen, I would consider in that group. You guys are bringing some great content to people. You're doing things that people want to see. You're not afraid to cover the stories that are important and give people the real story on what's going on. You ask the good questions. So I will say, you, my friend, were there as one of those people you've just described. So congrats to you. But you got a long way to go. You got, you're a young guy. I hope you'll continue to contribute, both of you, for a long time. Way after I'm done in this profession.
So we're gonna hold the torch, man. We're gonna keep running, all right?
We're counting on you guys. We're counting on you guys for that, for sure.
But I really wanted to, in this podcast interview, really just break down those 10 topics. I mean, let's take it from the top with the, you know, the business acumen. Like, let's just go through each one of these so folks can really understand, you know, the importance of these topics that have been brought to the attention of the eye care industry.
Fantastic. Happy to do it. And business acumen is a great one to start with, because when I took the job, I heard from a lot of my friends and colleagues about, man, you have to solve this problem. We are graduating. This is what people would say to me, the best clinicians we've ever graduated. And every year they continue to get better. But you guys are doing a crappy job when it comes to helping them prepare for the business of optometry. And you know what? I say, yes, I agree. The challenge and the problem is that we're not going to solve it anytime soon in the four-year curriculum. And just very briefly, and I won't get into too much of the weeds here, but I think it's important to understand that, you know, we try to do business education in second, third, and fourth year. But put yourself in the shoes of a student, and it wasn't too long ago for you guys, so I hope you can appreciate this. Your first, second, and third year, you could care less about, I mean, you know, business is important to you, but the focus is taking your national boards, passing your exams. You're not thinking about the business of optometry. And even when we try to do courses, it's sort of the last thing anybody's going to study for, the last thing they're going to pay attention to. Now, fast forward, you get to your fourth year. And in your fourth year, you think, this is critical. I need to know it. And now we're separated all over the country at our externships. So given the current format of optometric education, it will be, at least in the short term, extremely difficult to say we're going to solve the problem of business acumen during the four-year program. So we talked a lot at the meeting in Boston about the idea of how can we create perhaps a postgraduate program. It could be right immediately following graduation, an intensive, you know, 4-day, 3-day, whatever the right time is, to introduce, no matter what environment you're going to be in optometry, and we are all in so many different environments, that you at least have the basics of business of optometry. One great suggestion that came out of that meeting that we hope to be able to pursue. So, you know, it's easy to sit on the outside and say, you know, I love what you guys are doing here, but you're doing a crappy job here. That's why this dialogue is so important. So people understand the challenges, people who can make a difference. And I got to salute people like J&J and Essilor and Luxottica, my friends at Jobson, and, you know, a few others who really stepped up at this and said, what can we do? How do we solve it? And at that meeting, Daryl, you know, we had the AOA sitting in the room, Academy sitting in the room, ASCO sitting in the room, SECO sitting in the room. That was huge to see that kind of support and collaboration, and that's what's going to get the job done. So starting off, business acumen, it's a key one. I don't meet anybody who says you're doing a fantastic job teaching people the business of optometry. We have to do better, and with help. And also, just one other quick thing about that. Think about these industry partners. They have incredible marketing people. They have incredible salespeople. They have incredible IT people, HR, all the functions that would be really helpful for us to understand better. So they have those resources. So that's a key one. Of all of them, I think that's the one that really we felt like could be addressable pretty quickly. And this partnership could really change things a lot about that optometrists were producing and how comfortable they are with the business of optometry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we could take a lot from industry in regards to just running a business. I mean, I know one of our colleagues from Lunch Date, Rachel and Kate Ham, she did that program over at Essilor this past summer, and that was before she actually started practicing, and she said that changed her entire perspective in regards to just practicing in general, and now it's actually taken her to the next level with just being her first year out of school.
Yeah, and think about it, it gives you more confidence too, right? I mean, you guys got out there and you've got a lot of confidence in doing what you're doing. But you have smart people, but without the confidence and understanding at least some of the basics of the business of optometry, I think it starts to narrow, at least in people's minds, what their options are. And we don't want that. We want them to feel like they've got all the options. You know, I know when we talk about independent, private, whatever you like to call that type of practice where we're on our own, you know, you are on your own, and you do have to make some of those same decisions. And financial is a piece of it. But I continue to hear over and over in my times in industry, it's also about confidence in running a business. So if we can help with that, perhaps we even open up the opportunities for more of our colleagues to say, I kind of like this independent private practice option. Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's move on to number two, impact of technology on optometry. I mean, that's a huge thing. We're seeing it, as you mentioned earlier, right now.
Yeah, but you forgot the second half of that was equally as important. The impact of technology on optometry and the impact of optometry on technology. Really, okay. Both are critically important. And I say that because we can let this influence us and sit back and say, oh my God, this technology, it's changing us. How's it going to change us? What are we doing? And I have to give credit to Mark Ferrara and the Jobson people, because we had this discussion several years ago. And the idea was to try to stimulate some creative thinking, some innovation from inside. We sat through the wonderful Global Leadership Summit that Jobson puts on every year at Vision Expo, and we continue to see all these people from outside of our industry coming in with all the disruptive things. I want to see some people from inside this industry coming up with ways to disrupt and change and evolve, whatever terms make you feel okay about it. It's critical. So I was very intentional. I didn't mean to pick on you on that one, but it was very intentional to say both of those pieces, because I want to try to push the envelope of let's optometry should dictate some of these technologies, how they evolve, what they do. And being in Boston, it's really interesting. Being in Boston, across the street from MIT, down the road from Harvard, right next to BU and BC and UMass and the incredible, and also Mass General and Mass Eye and Ear. The stuff that's going on in this city is amazing. And one of the advantages actually we have at being at NICO, just saying, is that we're in the heart of that, and we're really trying to take full advantage. So it's critical, this telehealth thing. You know, there's always a silver lining, I hope, and maybe a little too soon to be talking about silver linings with regard to this pandemic. But if there is a silver lining, I think it's a couple things. We're learning that we can teach and teach effectively, virtually, certainly on the didactic side. And we're also learning that telehealth can be an incredible vehicle when used appropriately. And I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting that we start treating everybody through telehealth. In fact, our institution has been working hard at validating. And I think that's really important. We're working with a lot of these telehealth companies to help them validate their technology. But optometry needs to be involved. I love my friends at the AOA. I love my friends who are in optometric leadership. But we have to be involved in the discussion. We want a seat at that table. And I'm not sure anybody disagrees with that, but I feel like at times things we do distance us from having a seat at that table. So that was the point of that. The reality, technology is changing our profession. When I talk to young colleagues who are still in school, they're excited about it. They're not intimidated by it. And I love that, because my generation, you know, it makes us nervous, you know, we kind of like things to kind of be as they are, right? So it's inspiring, as I said earlier, to be around these students, but we need that's the key message here. And that's why I want the industry to partner with us in this area, is we need to have a seat at the table. We need to be influencing it. Nobody better to do that than us, because we understand it better than anyone does. So that was really the point of that. We got a lot of support for this idea of, you know, how optometry is going to lead when it comes to the technology side. Even if we're not innovating it, at least influencing it. I think that's critically important, because if we're not careful, it takes us off without us, and now we're just taking a ride versus sitting in that front seat, at the very least in the passenger seat. I love to see us in the driver's seat, but we'll work towards that.
I like the way you think.
You and I have always, all three of us have kind of seen eye to eye. I love how you guys push the envelope on things too. And that's why I'm always happy and flattered and honored actually to participate in these discussions.
Well, you know, we have a lot of love for you, man, because you were like our first big major podcast.
I hope you were going to remember that. I was with you guys at the beginning, and it was a lot of fun then. And I'm so really actually proud and thrilled to see how this has evolved and how much people enjoy, and not surprising, listening to the things that you put out there and the fact that you want to tackle some of the important issues that are on everyone's mind. So, but yeah, I'm proud of that as well. The fact that we were in it a little bit together at the beginning, and I appreciate that opportunity.
Absolutely.
Not needless to say, this little Essilor Luxottica thing was going on. I'm sure it was my charming personality. However, I do appreciate that was a pretty big issue at the time.
Well, you know, the one thing that I've always liked about you is that, you know, in our terminology, you keep it real with us. You know, there's no BS, you know, there's no sugarcoating. You know, you're always just telling us the truth. You're telling us the facts. For me also, I take it a step further. You actually show up to every single thing as well in industry. You're not just showing interest in one thing. You know, being a part of the National Optometric Association. You know, I always see you at every single event. And for me, being a black doctor, a black physician, to see someone outside of my own race to come in and support every single time at Vision Expo or every single event, to me, that's just that's amazing. It shows your passion for the industry. Tremendous.
Well, that I would have to say that means as much to me as anything you've said to me. And can we take a pause on that subject? Can we dig into that just a minute? I know it wasn't on your agenda, but I do want to mention this because, and being real, and let's be real, okay? I come to NACO. We are very diverse at NACO, all right? We have probably one of the largest LGBTQ plus organizations, and I'm incredibly proud of that. We have an Asian American population that is incredibly strong. We have religious beliefs all across the spectrum. And that was wonderful. And when I arrived, it was, we are very diverse here. And that's great, except for we have gaps. And the biggest gap is the one you just mentioned. It's people of color. It's African American. It's Latinx. We are continuing to struggle in encouraging people of color to become optometrists. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg, right? I bring a student to campus. They want to see faculty members. They want to see other students that look like them. Is this the place where I should be? And yet, if I don't get students coming in, I'll never have more faculty and more people around the institution. So it has become a primary focus for our institution. And it's not just honestly about going to historic black colleges and universities. That's great, and we're doing that. But we have to find a path that makes sense, and we have to get out there talking to the right people. One other quick story. Wonderful woman, and she heads up diversity and inclusion at Harvard Medical School. And she's just, I mean, look at her resume. You can only imagine, right? And I went to visit her because someone introduced me to her, and I just had a quick conversation with her. So you've been at Harvard Medical School for 20 years. You can have the pick of any students in the entire country. I mean, that's my would be my perception. Who does? What medical student doesn't want to go to Harvard Medical School, right? I mean, it's pretty much anyone. So tell me, how would you rate how you've done in 20 years at bringing a diverse and inclusive environment to Harvard Medical School? Now, I'll caveat the answer by saying she's a very humble person, so she's never going to give herself a 10. She said, you know what? Honestly, I would probably give myself a 6. And I was actually shattered by that. Here is someone who could have, in my mind, the pick of anybody she wants. She has this incredible credentials and background. She happens to be African-American as well. And yet, she still would give herself a score of 6 on how well she's done. It was a bit demoralizing, I have to say, for about a minute and a half. And then we had some great discussions about how we can improve that and what perhaps my institution, excuse me, could do to try to support that. And we're working together with her, along with an agency that we brought into the institution to say, I want to do an assessment of where we are today. Before we go out there and start saying we're going to get aggressive in recruitment, we better make sure our own house is in order and that we have an environment that is inclusive and that is diverse and that is equitable. And you know what? You've said keeping it real. I'll tell you, there's been some surprises. You know, I knew we weren't perfect, but we've got a lot of work to do. And that's where we're going to start. We're going to create an environment where people feel comfortable being and everybody feels inclusive. And this is a project we've been working on. The students are involved. The faculty is involved. And I'm sorry to get a little on my soapbox, but you mentioned it, and it's such a key element for us. And I think it's a key element for the future of our profession. Our patients tend to look like us. If you believe that, then we have an even bigger problem because now we're not servicing a community that is underserved. Huge issue. ASCO continues to talk about it. We are focused on it at our institution, and I have great people in the Boston area that are going to help us succeed. We will succeed. I'm absolutely certain we will. The question is, how long will it take us? But we are committed to it. So sorry, I know I went off on that one a little bit, but it's incredibly important. I love what NOA is doing. You know, back in the day, one more thing about NOA, and I love the originators of that group. They're amazing people. What they used to do, and I think they need to go back to doing it. When I was at Nova, I was at Nova for 5 years. They would bring us to every NOA meeting. And every dean, president, or representative would sit there, and they would, Dr. Powell, I think, would point his finger at us and say, all right, from last year, how have you done? Tell me your numbers with students. Tell me your numbers with faculty. Tell me your numbers with upper administration. I don't want to know about your secretaries. I want to know about your upper administration.
Accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me tell you what, that next year, we were making sure we did a good job because I didn't want to sit in front of Dr. Powell again and get beaten up over that, man. Let me tell you. So I love what they're doing. Cheryl was a student of mine at Nova. I love her, who's the current president. I love what NOA does. We'll continue to participate there. But I will say, when I sit in some of these meetings that I've seen you at and been there, I hear stories that make me very uncomfortable. We have to do a better job. I hope people like yourself and Jen and others will continue to push us on that, to call us out on it, to make sure we're doing what we need to be doing. Absolutely. There. That pressure doesn't hurt, my friend. It Absolutely. Really doesn't. I know it's done when done in an appropriate way. That doesn't hurt at all.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%.
Dr. Purcell, I know we're not going to have a lot of answers this evening as the country is dealing with what coronavirus is doing across all industries, but could you give us some insight on what issues you're facing at the college right now with this disease?
Yeah. And first of all, I want to wish all your listeners and the two of you, you know, to be healthy and be careful. It's a scary thing. And I, you know, I have to admit right up front, it's scary. But you know what? The reality is we're going to get through this. The challenges at the school are twofold. They're in one way similar, very similar to what our colleagues are facing, what you guys are facing in practice, which is how do we continue to care for our patients? We can't abandon our patients, but for us, we have to protect our students and our faculty. And so as a result, we've really had to pull back on our clinical activities. From a financial standpoint, that's a huge hit, but it's the right thing to do, and we absolutely have to do it. So as I mentioned earlier, we've moved to telehealth. So we are still there for our patients. We're triaging patients through our telehealth vehicle. And if we need to see them, our faculty will go to our clinics and see them if necessary. 9 out of 10 cases, we're able to talk to them. We're able to deal with things, and we can actually ship contact lenses. Candidly, a lot of the triage has been, oh my God, I'm out of my contact lenses and I need my lenses. So we got to deal with the basics as well. But telehealth has been a great resource for that. But listen, I recognize the pressure it puts, and we have the same pressures now. Our income has dropped significantly, yet we don't want to do anything but continue to take care of our people, our employees, our students, and everybody involved, our faculty. So that is a huge challenge. As long as this lasts for, you know, a short window, and nobody knows really, right? But as long as this lasts in a short window, you know, 2 to 3 months, I think most of the schools and colleges can manage that in whatever way they choose to do it. In our case, we're in very good shape financially, so we are prepared for, you know, a 3-month, a 4-month kind of issue, a year-long issue, and we are all going to have serious consequences from something like that that we'll have to deal with. In the classroom, you know, we had a little bit of an advantage there in that we had already done something called Panopto, where if you as a student wanted to see the lecture after at home and go through it, we had all recorded those things. Some of our faculty would do them live. So we were already in somewhat of a position to be able to manage that. And that we were able to turn on very quickly. So the didactic component of the program has really not missed much of a beat. The challenges will be, of course, in the grading process. The challenges will be with our students who may not have enough hours to graduate from the clinical side. Mm. Our faculty has done an amazing job of coming up with cases and being able to review cases and dig into them with students and get them to think through these. Is it as perfect as seeing a patient? No, but it's going to represent that last little piece that we perhaps won't be able to accomplish with real patients. At least we can do it through case presentations and evaluations. And our faculty have just done an outstanding job of creating a platform for that that I think is really well done. In addition to that, the Academy and ASCO are working on some great programs together where all these wonderful cases the Academy has will be able to be utilized by it. And Barb Caffrey, who's the president of the Academy, has done a wonderful job with this, be able to be utilized by our students, enabling them to graduate, we hope, without any delay. And that's the goal, to help our students, our seniors, to graduate without any delay. But there's so much fallout, Jen. I mean, think about graduation. I mean, it's such an important part. You guys work so hard for 4 years to bring your families together and to do this. And we are absolutely heartbroken by the fact that commencement appears to be, you know, we appear to not be able to do it, at least in the time frame we want. So here's what we're going to do. People are going to get their diplomas. They're going to graduate. We're trying to really separate graduation from the commencement ceremony. You, hopefully everyone will graduate in the right timing. Boards will get back up and operational, and we'll have very little disruption there. Our intention is, because by the way, we served up this idea of what about a virtual commencement? And boy, I would tell you, you want to get students to agree on something. They thought it was the worst idea they'd ever heard. Oh, wow. So we scrapped that one. And we will do a commencement sometime, hopefully in the summer, where we will be able to bring families together and have the ceremony, which we hate to, we really, really hate to miss. So, you know, those are some of the obstacles. But we're facing some of the same things practitioners are. How long can you stay away from patient care and survive. You know, I mean, schools and colleges perhaps have a little bit of a nest egg. Some practitioners do, but the practitioners who haven't put away something for a rainy day, I absolutely appreciate that this is a difficult time, and we certainly hope we can get back to patient care. But I would encourage them to look at the telehealth option. At least allows you to continue care, to not abandon your patients, to not put yourself at any increased risk, or at least minimize that, and then also be able to generate some income, because you can sell glasses, you can sell contact lenses, and you can have visits, which, by the way, as I think you know, some of the regulations around telehealth and reimbursements have been loosened a bit. So it puts us in a nice position to be able to avail ourselves of that, of those opportunities. So it's incredibly disruptive, but I know everybody's in the same boat, and we are all working hard together. Schools and colleges have come together like they never have before to support each other. We always have supported each other, but in a way I've not seen in my almost 2 years, year and a half now of being in academia. So those are probably some of the key elements, but it's the stress on the students that I really worry about. There's so many unknowns. Do I go home? You know, we have about 20% of our students are from Canada. So do I go home? Do I stay? How do we know when you're going to start up again? And these are the things that keep me up at night, because I know it creates so much anxiety for our students, but we're trying our best. You know, you're just trying to look out with your crystal ball. And
I want to kind of circle back to, you know, a few more of these topics from the top 10 things that you guys were discussing at the meeting. One thing that really was very dear to my heart, because I still have some student loans, was the debt and cost of education. And then you guys made a big, big point that really resonated with me, and that was that we're going to price ourselves out of the game. Let's really dive deep into that, because that's a topic that, you know, the future folks that want to jump into optometry, current students, especially with this whole COVID-19 thing, they're really concerned about student loans and how they're going to pay this, especially if they lost their job or the practice closed or they're laid off. So let's just dive into this a little more in detail, Dr. Purcell.
Yeah, and I'm actually glad you asked that. It is such a critical issue, and I'm not sure there's too many more important than that. It's getting, you know, the students interested in optometry, and then how do we reduce debt and the cost of education? They are somewhat two separate issues. But let me back up just for a very quick second. I want to make sure it's clear. These 10 things that came out of the meeting, came from the people who attended. These were the things we did a survey up front. What do you think are the key issues facing optometric education? And then at the back end, we did another one. And then we had these breakout groups where we talked about them. So I do want to make it clear, this is not NECO or Howard Purcell's top 10. These are the things that the industry leaders and our media and our employers really thought were the key elements. And this one, you know, you can't have a discussion about challenges in education, period, but optometry in particular. Let me give you just a quick graph that's really simple to understand. Today, when you think about cost of living, just basic cost of living increases, you're probably looking at 2.5%, anywhere between 2-3% increase in cost of living, okay? So let's just agree to that. We could debate it, but let's just agree to that for a moment.
Okay.
What we've decided our institution is we have to hold the increase, if we're gonna increase at all, of optometric education to about 1.5%. In fact, we should try to keep it flat. But let's say for a minute that we can continue to increase at about 1.5% a year. Doesn't take a lot to do the math, right? If you're increasing somewhere between 2-3% in your costs, because that's cost of living, and you know the biggest cost we have is our faculty. They're the key, faculty, administration, et cetera, right? Yeah. So if that's going up 2-3%, and yet we can only do our best to keep it flat at maybe 1.5%, it doesn't take a math genius to figure out those graphs don't go in the right direction. We have to address this. And so the key element is going to be, in my humble opinion, support from industry and from employers. They're going to have to get some skin in the game on this, provide more scholarships, provide opportunities. You know, let's go back to the old, and you guys have no idea what this probably even is, the old GI Bill approach, right? Okay, I'm an employer, and I want you to work for me, Daryl. And I love you because I think you're the right kind of guy for the place I need, and you know, you're willing to go somewhere rural where we can't get optometrists to go. You know what I'm going to do for you? I'm going to pay for your education. I'm going to pay for those 4 years for you, and you agree to give me maybe one for one. You're going to give me 4 years of working for me in a rural area where I really desperately need someone. Think about that for a minute now. You're walking out of optometry school with no debt. Well, let's say minimal debt. You're going to have a great job for 4 years, and then you can make up your mind where to go. One example of many of the ideas that came out of this good brainstorming session we had. But what became clear was we need help. We can't do it by ourselves. Costs continue to go up. And if we continue to raise tuition at 2, 3, 2.5, 4% a year, we will very quickly price ourselves out of the game. It's an easy math problem. It's not that complicated. Now, the solutions are a little bit more complicated. The good news is industry and employers are ready to do those things. We have a few obstacles. There's some little legal matters. And if, when people listen to that, oh, well, we can't do that. We can't do that. We can't do that. Just like people are telling me, we can't diversify. You know, we can't bring more people of color into optometry. I think you're like me. You two guys are like me. Tell me I can't do something, and I'm going to do it. I'm going to prove you wrong. I promise you, I'm going to prove you wrong. So we're going to prove it wrong that legal issues get in the way, that we're worried about industry getting too much involved in academia. They have to, for our survival, for in order to continue to get the best students to come to optometry. We cannot continue to increase the cost of education and that debt burden. I mean, every time I quote a number, you know, I started off, I was saying 100, you know, 150 and 175 and 200 and, you know, and every time I say a number, students are telling me, no, it's actually more than that.
What's the other magic number that you've heard so far? Like, what's the average that you keep hearing?
180, somewhere in that ballpark, yeah, or higher. But you know what? We have to address it. We have to go. And the other piece, Daryl, and I mean this as no disrespect to anybody, and hope no one takes it this way. We have to help young students who are coming into optometry school understand the implications of taking those loans and how to minimize that. Really interesting question that came out in the panel with the students. And I think the entire audience was just stunned by this. They asked our students, you know, what is the top thing in your mind? What do you think you're thinking about all the time? You have to be thinking about the debt you're accruing. And what was really interesting to a person, we had five people on the panel, not thinking about that at all. Right now, I'm thinking about passing boards, passing my tests. When I get to graduation, I'll start thinking about my debt. And I think the room was just, people's jaws hit the floor. And I don't blame our students for that. I understand with the pressures, and we've already talked about this, with the pressures of optometry school, the way they are, it's intense and you have to be thinking about those things. So now the burden becomes on administration, on industry, on employers, and even the media, where you guys can help us get these messages out. You play a critical role. And I don't care what our president of the United States says. You play a critical role. Sorry, I didn't mean to get political there. I'll apologize to my Republican friend. Anyway, you play a critical role in disseminating information, in challenging people, and asking the good questions. And I love that. And everything I've listened to what you guys do, you don't hesitate doing that. We have to do that. We absolutely have to do that because, you know, for the next 5 to 7 years, optometric education is, in at least my institution, because I know all the numbers, next 5 to 7 years, we're in great shape, unless this pandemic turns out to be something far worse than we could ever. It already is far worse than we could imagine, but even extends longer. We're in pretty good shape for the next 5 to 7 years. After that, the numbers aren't working anymore. So here's the good news. We have about 5 years or so to have these good, important, hard discussions. And once we have those, we are smart. We have a lot of smart people in this industry. We will solve it, but we will solve it together, not in isolation, not in pointing fingers. And that is the whole idea of this industry collaborative that we started. And I'm just so thrilled you guys are part of it. And so many other people have seen the value in doing it. We have some time. It's not going to happen tomorrow, at least given what we've known historically. It's not going to happen tomorrow. We have a little time. When things are good, that generally good, that's when we have to start making those important decisions about how we're going to plan for the future. We have that opportunity, and I'm counting on people like you guys and my wonderful industry partner friends and my wonderful employee partner friends. We all are symbiotic. We all rely on each other. And we recognize that. And as a result, we all better be working together. So, yeah. I didn't mean to preach to you. That was a little bit of preaching, I think.
It's all good. You know, we got, you know, Preacher Purcell on today. It's all right. It's
show, man. It's church. I don't know that I've ever been called that. So, I don't mind it because it's important. And I know you know it's important. I know that's why you ask those good questions.
Absolutely.
We cannot ignore this. We cannot assume that rich kids are going to be able to keep coming to optometry school and this is not going to be an issue. We have to have a diverse class, and therefore we better make sure that people who are underrepresented see a path, that people who can't afford optometry school see a path, and that the best of the best want to go to optometry school. Because you know what? It's the best profession out there. You change people's lives every day. In 4 years, you're walking out making six-figure salaries. You're a doctor and the prestige that goes with this, and you can have a decent work-life balance. I mean, if I can talk to people about optometry, I can convince people it's a great profession. We just need to get out there more. And by the way, ASCO doing a great job with Optometry Gives Me Life and really trying to be proactive about showing people the path, and a lot of other people really doing a good job at trying to help promote the profession. We're the best kept secret in medicine, as far as I'm concerned, and we don't want to be the best kept secret.
Absolutely.
I hope I answered your question.
You did. Absolutely, you did. One last question to sum up everything or to end everything. You know, we have to work together, but you know, when it comes to optometry, there's this one term that folks really get nervous about, and it's known as private equity. I continuously hear that private equity is going to ruin optometry. This is one of the topics that you guys were talking about at this meeting. Elaborate on that in regards to the conversation and dialogue that actually took place in that.
Yeah. A lot of people are worried about it, you know, and I think for good reason. I'll start with the end and then we can backtrack.
Okay.
What I worry about the most is now you're going to have several thousand practices aggregated. And what private equity does, and I'm not throwing stones, I'm just talking reality, they're going to make their money and move on. What happens to these couple thousand, whatever number you want to put on it, 3,000, 4,000, I don't know, you know, every time that's another one like tuition, you know, or debt keeps going up every time I hear it. What is going to happen to those practices? They're going to knock on the door of the Essilors and these kind of people, maybe VSPs. I don't see them buying those huge numbers of practices. I don't see that happening. I really worry about the end of this story. I think it's great. A lot of our colleagues, the upside starting at the beginning, people who were going to walk away from their practices or struggle selling them are now getting what in many cases they deserved and they should have gotten for their valuable practice that they've built. So from that standpoint, it's very appealing to people, and I see why it's grown the way that it has. The other reason, Daryl, if we're just being straight up with each other here, is most optometrists are not good business people. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, a private equity person comes in who's all business-minded. They see so many ways to increase the profitability and lower the cost. Might not be things we really love to see, but they can do that pretty easily in the majority of these optometric practices.
Right.
So look, you know what? It's good in some ways. It's not good for everybody. What I would hope to see is before you get so excited about numbers and seeing numbers in your head, think about how long you built that practice. Think about the patients you serve and the way you've served them. You better be comfortable if you're selling that practice and somebody else making those decisions and doing it in a different way. For my colleagues who've done it, who've been happy about it, I salute them. But I talk to a lot of people who just don't even recognize their practice anymore, and it's incredibly difficult for them. We can't make private equity go away, but what we can do is try to be really selective about decisions we make. And then here's the other piece, and I hope this will be the case. I hope my friends at VisionSource and my friends at iDoc and my friends at name all those out there who have private equity behind them as well can find ways for our young graduates when they come out to move into some of these practices, to help fund something like that, to help them be better business people. Then everyone wins. We have a more profitable practice. These aggregates, these alliances will continue to grow. I don't think a lot of people talked about it, but I think our saving grace perhaps could be these large alliances that aggregate practices together that can create, I think, a better or at least a competitive option to selling your practice to private equity, who, God bless them, and a lot of my friends are involved in it now, but the people at the top making those decisions don't care a whole lot about optometry. They care about profitability, and I don't blame them. That's what their business is. But I would love to see, and it's already starting to happen, our friends at VisionSource, our friends at iDoc and others stepping up and creating at least alternatives. And they're starting to do it, and I think it will have an impact.
Absolutely. I mean, both of us, Daryl, have worked in private equity-backed businesses, and we see the pros and cons of these situations. And I think because private equity in this iteration is still really new within the marketplace and changing so fast, once you think you know what private equity home practice is like, it's totally different in a few years. And honestly, with coronavirus right now, that might totally change the landscape of what a private equity-backed practice looks like within this next year, because suddenly it's not so profitable to have an optometric practice that doesn't see patients or is doing telemedicine exams at a fraction of what they were typically doing.
That's so right. But you know what? These people are smart, by the way. And what they see is that, and this is a good lesson to learn for all of us from this experience of private equity, our practice can be more profitable. We can find ways to lower our cost, not by, you know, using less quality product, but lowering our overall cost, increasing our profitability. That's so obvious. Otherwise, all these private equities would not be coming into this space and investing what they're investing. It's a great lesson learned. And honestly, and I think it's a great segue to tie back to where we started in business acumen, right? Mm-hmm. We talked about we have to improve our own business acumen, because as a result of that, we will have more profitable and successful practices. And when private equity comes knocking on the door, at least we have a choice to make. Hey, you know what? I see my practice continuing to grow. I'm okay where I am. Or, you know what? This makes sense. I'd like to go the private equity route. But I feel like it's, in some cases, it's a little out of balance because we don't all have that good, smart business acumen we can bring to the table. No fault necessarily of our colleagues. Fault of the educational process. But I did try to explain that perhaps there are challenges inherent there. But that doesn't mean we can't solve it. And with this industry collaborative, with help of our friends at Defocus Media and all your smarts and the people who listen to you, we can get the job done and increase the profitability and success of our practices if we want, without the help of private equity.
I think we covered some of the huge issues facing all of optometry, not just...
We got it all solved now.
God. But like, this is a good summary of everything that everyone's concerned about in optometry right now. And luckily, the questions and the concerns have been pinpointed, and so now working towards solutions. So I applaud the work that the industry collaborative is doing and the pledge that you guys have made for us to work together across colleges, across the industry, across professionals to try to get some solutions to these major issues.
By the way, you made the commitment too. Daryl signed for you. I don't know if he told you that.
You know what? That's fine. He didn't, but if he hadn't, I would virtually sign right now.
Oh, I love you. I knew I loved you from the beginning. Thank you guys, really. And I appreciate everything you're doing to try to educate all of us. I salute you for your efforts. You know, you're young people in this profession. You're the future of this profession. And I will tell you, and maybe this is a good way to end, the future of this profession is in great hands. I hang out with them every single day, and I know that's the case. I'm so excited about where we're going and what we have in front of us. And with help of people like you bringing these key issues to the table and giving us a forum to discuss it, we will solve it. So thank you guys very much. Thanks for participating in the Industry Collaborative. And I'm happy to come back anytime if I can be of any help to you and your listeners.
Well, for anyone that's listening right now and they want to be a part of this or ask you more questions or know when that next meeting is and the location, which probably is going to be tentative now due to all this stuff taking place, you can just give us some feedback in regards to that.
Oh, you're so good, man. I appreciate that very much. So, yeah. So we were hoping to have the meeting in October. My hope is it will still happen in October. We would love anybody who wants to participate. And the truth of the matter is, Daryl, Gary, Chu, and I, who started this thing, hoped we'd have 10 or 12 people show up to the meeting. We had almost 70 show up representing 44 different companies, and we want everybody who wants to participate. So here's what I'll tell you. PurcellH@necco.edu. Give me a shout. Let me know you want to participate. We'd love to have your brains, your energy, your resources, whatever you can bring to the table. And by the way, resources doesn't just mean money. It means your time and your brain power. So thank you. And I'll say it one more time. Purcell, PurcellH at necco.edu. Let me know you're interested. And thank you for that opportunity, Daryl and Jen.
Yeah, thank you. We have Pastor Dr. Howard Purcell in the building, you guys. Thanks for listening to us and have a great day. And as always, peace. It's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Daryl Glover, and the lovely Dr. Jennifer Lyerly. You guys have a great one.
All right, colleagues, and it's a wrap. Thank you dearly for hanging out with the Defocus Media team. We hope truly something resonated with you. And if it did, be sure to give us 5 stars. And make sure you follow us on all social media platforms. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, you named it. And our handle is at Defocus Media on all platforms. And until next time, be sure to keep it 2020. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.